Maybe he's right. Maybe there is something the matter with me. Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete?
Copy written, so don't copy me.
Could be bad. Could be bad. I just don't see how a world that makes such wonderful things could be bad.
The loudspeaker spoke up and said,
run through the fields. I have spoke with the tongue of angels. I have held the hand of a devil. Hello and good morning. You are listening to 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and distributed by thesyncbook.com. You can find our archives at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. This is Alan Green, and I am joined by Will Morgan and Andras Jones as we speak with Mark Hosler of the groundbreaking media activist group Negative Land. Negative Land has created many years of music and many years of legal battles, famously bumping heads with U2 and Casey Kasem. They put the concepts of fair use on the map, and we owe a lot to them. After losing former lead vocalist Don Joyce this July, the band has made over 700 episodes of Joyce's weekly live radio program, Over the Edge, on KPFA-FM in Berkeley, available as the Over the Edge Archives. Today's guest also asked the final question at the Radio 8 Ball show at the 2014 Olympia Sync Summit. Mark Hosler, welcome to the show.
Hello!
I think that I'll throw the first volley for questions.
Oh, yeah. And I should say, too, Don wasn't, well, in a strange way, he was our lead vocalist, but not in the way that listeners would, not in a conventional way. He, when we performed live, was the fellow who tended to play most of the cut-up found voice tapes that we use a lot in our work. And that's kind of what we meant by that. Not that he actually, I think the one time he sang on one of our records was he is the vocalist for the track Car Bomb and Escape from Noise. But other than that, no, he doesn't actually sing, but he did an amazing job of, he was particularly good. We all are like using found sounds and found everything, but he had a particularly amazing ability to cut together found voices from all kinds of sources to create kind of a new, you know, bigger picture out of it in our work.
Well, that brings so many questions to mind, but let's stay on task here. I mean, first things first, lately we've been having this theme run through our work here at the Sync Book that has to do with a concept of, I guess, most easily understood as like Bizarro Land. I think it started with the Back to the Future Day when there's an alternate timeline that splits off, and we've kind of called it something like the other world, or, you know, it's like a negative representation of what our world is, like a parallel that would run right alongside it. And I can't help but think how that relates to the actual name Negative Land. I was wondering if you could explain to us exactly where that name came from and what it means to you.
Well, I think we sort of grew into the name. I think it's an appropriate name. It eventually became an appropriate name. But you've got to remember that when we started doing this, I was 17 years old. And we just wanted a name for our group because we thought it was more interesting to say we were a band, quote unquote, than I don't know. We'd never performed live or anything. It was a completely studio created thing done in our bedrooms, you know, just using tape decks and our crappy recording equipment that we had at the time. And when we actually decided to put out a record album, obviously on vinyl back then, you know, we didn't, we sort of toward the end of it all, I said, well, why don't we call ourselves something as if we're a band? We can sort of pretend to be one. That might be more interesting, you know, than, I don't know, what else are we going to call it? What do we call this? And, I was a particularly huge fan of a lot of what's sometimes called krautrock, German electronica music from the 70s. You know, of course, Kraftwerk, but Tangerine Dream, Klaus Schulze, Harmonia, Cluster, Neu, Rodelius, Mobius, all that stuff. And Neu put out this, at the time, I think, quite amazing, unique record. Their first album was in, I think, 71. And there's a track on it that's called Negative Land. And that is where the name comes from. It's the same spelling and everything. So I what's kind of funny to me years later is realizing that even our name is stolen. you know, given kind of what we ended up doing, the name itself is appropriated. But as the years evolved and we kept doing sound collage and appropriation, you know, we mix, and for people who haven't heard our work, it's a combination of mixing in our original sounds, and, you know, we can play our instruments, but we also use lots and lots of things we find in the media that we cut up and rearrange and put into our work. And as the years went by, I think it evolved from being kind of just pure Dada surreal weirdness, and we gradually realized you could use collage and appropriation as a way to talk about our culture, our country, our society, and talk about it in a rather interesting and unique and sort of paradoxically more honest way, because you're using the actual stuff to talk about this stuff. So I think that we gradually, I'm getting to your question, is that I think gradually I realized that the name, you know, we are in our work. One thing that unifies everything we've ever made is in some way or another, all of our stuff is this weird cracked mirror, spit up, chewed up version of looking at America. It's all about American culture, American society, power, politics, advertising, religion, everything. And in a way, you know, it is describing this kind of bizarre, our parallel universe, a negative land, something. I don't know. The names, anyway, as I said, the name kind of gradually to me seemed like, wow, we kind of accidentally, presciently picked a, you know, a good name. It works.
So then is it a double negative then? Because if it's America, it is already a pretty dark place, so.
I'm not worried about that level of explanation. That's for you. That's for the analysts and journalists to figure out. No, it just starts to sound. I think if I get into too much detail, it starts to sound a little too boneheaded and contrived. And that's something we really try and avoid in our work, is being contrived, being didactic, and trying to do stuff that obviously deals with, you know, we're not really writing love songs, but how do you deal with work that is talking about all these different types of issues, and do it in a way that is artful, you know, that is open to interpretation, that is interesting, creative, that invites the listener in and is not feeling like a lecture or something, a finger wagging, you know, little, we're telling you this is how to think about something. So it's a really interesting tightrope to walk, or a fine line that we try and do, is, you know, how do you deal with this stuff and not do it in a way that just sounds, as you know, as I said, kind of boneheaded. But I think we've managed, you know, plus a lot of our work is funny. I mean, there's a lot of humor in a lot of it, and that really helps a lot too.
Well, I think of, I have to admit, I haven't been able to sample it yet, but it's all in your head. I mean, or were you attempting to get a certain idea across there? I don't want to call you preachy, but what was your intent on that album?
That's probably one of the most ambitious things, if not the most ambitious project we've ever made, as far as the ideas. It is a 2-CD set that comes packaged inside of a real Bible, and it is about nothing less than why we human beings believe in God and why it's a big problem. So it's a gigantic topic. It's both for us, we felt it was both very timeless, because humans are always trying to figure out our place in the scheme of things and what it all means, but it's also very timely because, you know, since September 11th, 2001, we've seen fundamentalism, kind of come roaring back into the public sphere in this way that I never anticipated. I don't know if any of you did, but good Lord, you know, we had a president who thought God was telling him what to do, fighting against terrorists who think God is telling them what to do, and fundamentalism on all sides is just a dangerous, scary, crazy, problematic thing. But trying to do a project that looks at that, but also keeps a kind of a sense of compassion and empathy, because we're all humans, and you know, we're all trying to figure out why we're here. You know, that's a very human thing to do. So the project ends up dealing with Christianity, Judaism, Islam, suicide bombers, terrorism, you know, war on terror, how the brain works, neuroscience, you know, monotheism and fundamentalism kind of in general. Huge. And it took years to make. It was probably about 5 years in the making, because we were trying to fine tune it and hone in it. We toured with it we did about 35 live shows, and then the record emerged out of the live performances. Kind of made in reverse than how bands usually work. So it was a project that emerged from honing in and honing in and honing in on a really challenging topic for us. You know, again, how do you do this and not have it be, didactic, or, as you just said, preachy? You know, how do you do it? So that's, it's all in your head.
Well, maybe we can, this idea of 9/11 was a particularly dangerous time, and I feel like the fallout from it has been the most dangerous, sort of the shockwaves keep coming as we see how things
Look what just happened in Paris yesterday. That is absolutely, that would never have happened if we had not responded in the stupid, foolish way we did after, you know, September 11th, 2001. We should never have treated it as an act of war. That was the big mistake. It should have been treated as a crime and investigated and find the people and solve it. You know, it's a crime scene. It's not a war.
I don't know if you would use the same phraseology I would. To me, this is a product. It was a product of propaganda, where we are, the nation is influenced, as you say. You know, George Bush saying, God speaks to me, and everyone just sort of eats it up. Your 2008 album, and correct me if I pronounce any of this wrong, Thigmotactic.
Thigmotactic.
Refers to thigmotaxis, an instinctive reflex in response to physical touch or a stimuli. What are your thoughts on media eliciting an uncontrollable response from the media consumer?
Well, it, I mean, advertising is particularly good at that. I think that we're living in this bizarre, well, certainly if you go back to the 90s, the promise of the internet seemed to be, wow, we're going to all be able to talk to each other in all these incredible ways and share some of this information and be exposed to so many different perspectives and viewpoints and knowledge. And in fact, that can happen, but unfortunately, the unintended consequence of the internet and the web has been that it seems to be often the opposite, where people just gravitate toward their own little pockets, their own little niches, where everyone just reflects back to them in a big echo chamber, you know, just all saying and agreeing the same thing. They're not exposed to alternative viewpoints at all. It's actually worse than ever. To that degree, you have the media becoming this weird self-perpetuating kind of feedback loop thing, depending upon, you know, obviously the most obvious example of that is, you know, Fox News. You know, it's just absolutely dangerous, terribly dangerous. And in fact, they, to get eyeballs and to sell advertising, they've whipped their viewers up into such a frenzy that, you know, they're bringing us people like Donald Trump and Ben Carson, you know.
So obviously we have the dangerous aspect of media in you know, like a Fox News.
Well, also the stuff, again, this is all kind of pretty obvious, I would think, to you and your listeners, but it's just also we have, heck, what was it? Was it like 50 companies controlled and owned most of the mainstream media in this country 20, 30 years ago, and now it's down to 6? And of course, what are the interests that they represent? Well, they're interested in profit and so, you know, it's very, very, very dangerous. And if you have time like I do, but which most of my friends don't, to sit around looking at all kinds of alternative news sources, you can get, I think, a pretty interestingly broad perspective. You know, I like to read. I read Fox News. I read CNN. I read Al Jazeera. I'll look at various kind of social justice news aggregators like truthout.org or Common Dreams. But I really try and look at – I really do try and look at incidents that happen from a variety of viewpoints. I think that's a really healthy thing to do. But I also realize – I have kind of the luxury and privilege to even have time to do that, you know, and I'd say most people I know, most of my friends just don't, you know.
All right. So I want to, if you don't mind, this is more a personal thing. I'm going to sort of drop the pretense that, you know, I'm trying to do some sort of structured interview here, but I think, you know, that's a pretense that's got to just fucking go. So here's the deal. You're talking about this stuff. I mean, we have, you know, the negative land idea of like a culture jamming, which, you know, this is a possible solution, but also we also see things moving in a super dangerous direction.
Jamming a solution, by the way.
I'd love to hear your ideas on that.
It's a tactic, and I think it can raise awareness. It can also just be fun to do, and I think for the individual who does it, I think it can be empowering, it can be educational, it can be enlightening. So it's very, you know, I think it's a fantastic, you know, go and alter a billboard. I think it's great, but to think that it's going to, you know, as Adbusters has, I think, mistakenly promoted the idea that somehow this was going to change everything. I don't think it gets to the systemic roots of what we have that's going on in our, you know, in our country, our democracy, how capitalism works, all that, you know, unless you have things like campaign finance reform and, you know, you get rid of things like Citizens United, you can do all the culture jamming you want. And it is not going to undo the damage that's going on because of that stuff.
Talk to me about the TPP.
So, well, it's just, I don't know.
I mean, how best, like,
it's, yeah. I was actually, well, I lived in Olympia when I was with all those people in the streets that when the WTO was shut down in late 1999. And of course, TTP ends up looking like, you know, it is, as people often say, it's like the WTO agreements on steroids, you know, and it's literally like we are now literally living inside of a badly written dystopian science fiction novel, you know. So you see the powers that be, the so-called 1%, et cetera, the TPP is them kind of writing the rules. It's like their wet dream fantasy of how they'd like the world to run. It all works to their advantage and is to the disadvantage of absolutely everyone else and the environment, the planet, et cetera. And it's just so over the top. It's like a badly written sci-fi book. You know, it's just, you can't, it's like a cartoon version of how evil, you know, these people could be. And I just don't understand. It's sometimes hard to understand how that many sociopaths got into all these positions of power, but they did. And that's what it is it's a personality type. I remember years ago, looking at some of the policies being put forth by the Republicans and the whole Tea Party folks and all that, and you look at them and you kind of go, God, it's like these people are crazy. You know, how could they think such things and want to do stuff that's just so mean and cruel and nasty and hurtful to so many people? And I thought, well, wait, maybe the reason they seem like they're crazy is because they are crazy. You know? And we've actually, unfortunately, we've created a political and an economic system that literally rewards you with more power. You move up the scale, you move up to the top of the heap, the more you are willing to make choices that are sociopathic or psychopathic. Whether you are literally a sociopath or psychopath maybe doesn't matter. But if the system, if you try to be humane, ethical, fair, moral, and kind, the system spits you out. It literally does this, right? But if you make choices that are literally sociopathic and psychopathic, you get up to where, you know, look at who all the people who are running for the Republican president right now. They are all sociopaths, narcissists, and psychopaths. I mean, and I'm not exaggerating. I mean, they literally are. I mean, you can tell this. You just, you know, they're pathologically so.
Okay.
And I think most people in power, unfortunately, so that's what you see with this whole TPP thing. It's like, my God, it's amazing, though, that we can have this system where such a tiny percentage of people have so much power and control, because we outnumber them, you know, by, you know, whatever. We outnumber them by, you know, 6.9 billion to one, you know. So, yeah, it's and you just wonder, I mean, for all that stuff happening on the other side of it, the positive side of it is that I see the level of organizing, things happening in communities, things happening at the micro level, more and more wonderful things happening of people, you know, trying to organize themselves politically, socially, economically, and all that kind of stuff. So where it all goes, you know, I don't know. But we're sure as hell living through some really interesting times, right?
I got to challenge you, though, because I'm
challenge.
The gauntlet has been thrown.
Sure.
Because you're not really fighting that, you're using that, right? I mean, you're creating this confusion during consumption, but in a way, that's exactly what Trump is doing. He's just telling people what they want to hear, right?
So, no, what? I'm probably, what? You're saying, explain that again? Explain that better.
So you're creating confusion at consumption, right? So
no, who says we're doing that? How do you mean?
You are. I mean, I'm using your words actually, because when you make the U2 album that looks like a U2 symbol, or a single, excuse me,
and that was made 24 years ago.
Yes, sir.
To keep this in perspective.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not charging you. I'm just challenging you. But I mean, you created.
Well, we're doing a lot of things. There's a ton of things we're doing, I think, in our work. We're trying to, and that is one of them. Sure, that was an interesting thing to do. It was at that point in the that wasn't
it's
the
not
point
changing. It's not really trying to change anything. It's trying to just use people's own stupidity against them. And in a way, like Donald Trump's doing the same thing. He's not telling truth. He's using like a glossy veneer that people want to hear so that they'll buy into what he's doing. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but your question has a bunch of assumptions in it that you're not kind of teasing out, which is you're assuming Negative Land doesn't do anything trying to change someone's mind. You know, believe it or not, that's not what it may be a byproduct of what we're doing. And if that's true, that's fantastic. And we're not unaware of that. It's not that we're not conscious of it. But when we make our art, we actually really are very conscious about trying to make sure that it does work as art and as creativity. You know, we like making funny noises. You know, we like creating all this stuff. We just, you know, there's a lot of pure childlike joy and play in messing around with all these materials that we find. And in addition, we're dealing with topics that are socio-political, social justice, you know, in some of our work. It's not all of it. It's just the work that gets more press. There's a lot of there's other parts of our work too that deal with stuff that's more banal. But, so, you know, if it turns out that our work enlightens, educates, prods someone into some other perspective, it's all in your head. We sure as hell weren't making that thinking it was going to change someone's mind, because I'm assuming our audience is already atheist and agnostic to begin with.
What is interpretation, though? Like, health or stupid? What about the responsibility of somebody misinterpreting what you do?
Well, then that's just what happened. You're not responsible for someone misinterpreting what you do. I mean, it's in making art. I mean, I think in making any kind of creative work, it's going to be open to interpretation. And actually, that's part of what's really interesting about it is finding out how people interpret your work. I mean, it's interesting to me to when I meet people who like what we do or want to talk to us about it, or I do interviews. Part of what's really fascinating to me is finding out how people take or perceive our work. And sometimes it's in line with what we're thinking. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's perspective that surprised me. You're like, oh, I didn't quite see it that way. That's cool. So
I think
questions are neat, but they also presuppose. They're kind of presuppose. It's like you're reading into our work a whole bunch of super calculated intention, which is maybe fuzzier than you might think.
Can I jump in here for a second? Because there's something
You're kind of muffly on whatever microphone you're on.
Okay, I hope this is better. So just the difference between those, there's an interesting connection, and it's a sync connection you're making, which bypasses author's intention. So in a way, they show up on the same screen, so they look like part of the same thing, but it's like the difference between someone who's making a joke about something and someone who's trying to manipulate you into buying whatever they're selling. And I think that's a supreme difference between what you're talking about with whether it's repurposing U2 or it's like there's the guy on stage who's doing a parody. You can't blame Andrew Dice Clay for Donald Trump either, because one of them's making a joke and the other one is saying the exact same stuff, but he's deadly serious. It's very different. The author's intention is very different, and the actual art is different. Although I think it's a reasonable parallel from the standpoint of a viewer, you know, seeing like, oh, well, I can't tell the difference. Some people can't tell the difference between the joke and what it's making fun of.
Well, Helter Stupid actually in the liner notes explains how we lied. It was a hoax. You know, it's a long story, too long to go into in this interview, but it's a hoax we did that got us into the news. And we ended up making a record about this hoax that we did. And we explain in the liner notes very carefully what we did, how we lied, who we lied to, what happened. However, the audio doesn't carefully explain all that. Because the audio is meant to work as a work of art and creativity, and it's not trying to be an essay or a manifesto. So it's kind of writing a different kind of line. But especially nowadays, since so much music is being heard as in random shuffle play, you know, on your digital music player of choice, and there's no liner notes, there's no record cover, there's no context.
Right.
So I realized, wow, people could be, even today, hearing the Helter Stupid record we made in 1989, and someone who never ever ends up seeing the packaging, which was very much in our minds a part of the project, they'll never know. And they may actually, it inadvertently may perpetuate the hoax even further. And I find that interesting. I don't think that it's a little bit frustrating and strange, but I also just think that's really interesting.
Somewhat of a tangent to Will's question in this topic, do you think there's such a thing as dangerous art? Is there such a thing?
I think it's really great when, you know, I think it's harder to do nowadays than ever, but you look throughout all of history and you could see that there were certain moments when a novel, a painting, a performance, a symphony, you know, look what happened when Rites of Spring, that's famously, when it was premiered, there were riots in the audience because people were just losing their minds over hearing these dissonant tones together. Their brains couldn't deal with it. They were freaking out. You listen to that piece now and it just sounds like a nice piece of classical music. You know, when jazz in the 20s, everyone thought that the sinuous nature of that saxophone melody was going to make everyone tear their clothes off and all just jump into wild orgies. And, you know, you look at, I don't know, Elvis Presley, you know, the Sex Pistols, Andy Warhol. I mean, when you have art that seems to cause controversy, questions, thought-provoking, it's sort of offensive, I think that's just fantastic. It's great when those moments happen. And when we did the U2 single, the fact that it ended up being a stick up the ass of so many people in the music industry for us was very exciting. It was wonderful. We were very happy about that. And to me, I was around when punk rock was starting, and to me, punk rock in the early days was, it hadn't yet settled down into being a hairstyle and a way of playing, all the tropes weren't there yet. And punk to me was just as much about a perspective and an attitude and a point of view as it was about a barred E chord through a Marshall amp, you know. So to me, when we ended up doing the U2 single in 91, to me that felt very much in line with my own youthful idea of what punk was. You know, obviously that record doesn't sound punk in the slightest, but it kind of got people thinking and talking. But it's also just a really funny record. I think it works on its own just as a great, funny, you know, piece of audio collage. But it happens that it also prodded people to have arguments and debates and write papers and teach it in classrooms and, you know, all this other stuff came out of it. But again, there's this fine line, and I'm guessing for any of you there, you know, who, I mean, I know Andras is a musician. Are either of you guys, do you make stuff as well? Do you create?
Yes, sir.
Create things? Well, don't you, there's a kind of a, it's a kind of a cliche, but I think it's true that most people who are creative and artistic say, when you get asked, where do ideas come from? And you feel like you're just a channel, you're a vessel for this thing to happen.
Right.
You know, and to some degree, it's for you just to almost get out of the way and let it come through you, you know, and I don't know if that rings a bell with you guys, but that certainly does for me. It's often felt true.
Is that at all at odds with your sort of atheist, agnostic sort of veneer?
I'm not an atheist. Other members of Negative Land are, and certainly some of our fans are. But I don't think it's at odds with it at all. Doesn't mean I'm not saying it's coming from some spiritual.
Sure,
place.
Sure, sure.
I don't know where it's coming from, but there is just this sense of, you know, I mean,
it's a fascinating question mark. I'm with you on that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something I'll never know the answer to, and that's okay. But you know, when I think, well, my whole life, I've always questioned what I do with my time, my ability, you know, given my time on this planet, given the brain I ended up with, the color of my skin, my socioeconomic background, you know, just the stuff that I got saddled with on this time around. Am I doing the best am I using what I've been given to the best of my ability? You know, should I be out there, you know, as some shit stirring artist, noise music guy? I don't know. I've always questioned it. I really have, you know, but as I've gotten older, you know, I have accepted more and more, like, well, yeah, there's a ton of paths I could have taken. It happened to be this very peculiar one, but it is something that I have some skills and abilities at, and my friends who I work with collaboratively you know, amazingly enough, we all have stuck together over all these years to keep working together. We all recognize the value of collaboration. And, you know, some stuff has come out of it that, you know, seems like maybe, yeah, maybe there was, maybe we did do some okay stuff, you know, with our time here.
Okay, so we're going to start, we're going to start winding down here. So I think it's important that we kind of get to copyright.
The things you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, instead of Donald Trump. But, you know, I specifically want to know in a perfect world where Mark Hostler would have copyright laws.
Oh, that's funny. I get asked that question a lot, and my brain just doesn't go there because that's never going to happen. So it's almost sort of a waste of time for me to even entertain those ideas. But I do think that a world where anything less than the whole, you know, I think that when you look back at when copyright first began, do you know how long it lasted for? A lot of people don't.
No, not at all.
14 years. That's it. And that was not, nowadays that sounds like the most radical, lefty, progressive, crazy kind of idea on copyright. But that was conservative minds at the time thought 14 years was long enough for you to own, profit from. I mean, the idea of copyright right was that we want to incentivize people being creative and innovating in art and science and technology, because we give you a little way to make, you know, maybe make some money off it so that, it, you know, you can survive doing it. You know, that's the hope, the promise. We now live in a world where copyright lasts for the life of the creator plus 70 some odd years, meaning nothing will come into the public domain while you are alive. I think that's insane. I think that that's actually very dangerous and very stupid for the evolution of art and science and technology, because there's no such thing as an original idea. We all build on what came before us. So back in the day, copyright lasted for 14 years. Well, that would, you know, I'd love to return to that. Mark Twain hated it because all of his books were coming into the public domain while he was alive. But you know what it did? It encouraged him to write more books. And an example I've often given, what if J.D. Salinger's copyright to Catcher in the Rye had expired after 14 years? It would have kicked his ass, and he would have written a lot more great books. You know, maybe we would have, his talent and abilities and skills would have been shared with us a lot more than they were. You know, instead of having just one thing that's something that you, you know, you live off of for the rest of your life. So I don't know if that kind of answers your question, but yeah, it's, and that's, again, that's corporate influence, because corporations are immortal. They live forever. So of course, from their perspective, they want to own their property forever. There's no moment when Disney's going to say, oh, okay, well, that's fine. You people can have what, Mickey Mouse. We're okay with that now. You know, of course not. They're never going to say that. They're always going to fight to extend it.
But do you feel, like, I feel sometimes conflicted. I feel it's vital that we're able, as you say, there's nothing quote-unquote original that we're, and you use the term of, like, stealing. You stole the name. Sometimes it's, you know, who do we steal from, this the idea of stealing. I guess I want you to be able to clarify. But, like, I have a friend, Joe Alexander. He makes these amazing videos, and then someone started to download his videos, re-upload them to YouTube, claiming they were their own, right? And getting, yeah. And
but it's, that's not artistic approval.
Well, right. That seemed wrong. Yeah. And then I'm just trying, sometimes for myself, I'm trying to figure out where do you draw that line? And I know that's just kind of a variation of that same question, but do you feel there is a place to find that line? Or
that's not, as I said, that's not art. That's just pirating and bootlegging. And that's a whole other conversation. I think I've seen this happen a lot over the years is that they're two separate conversations and they get conflated together. And I can see why they do get conflated, but they're actually two separate conversations. There's appropriation. There's a conversation that I've been kind of where I'm coming from, where Negative Land's coming from, that has to do with art and creativity, and that is repurposing, transforming bits and pieces of things and reusing them in new ways to make what I would argue is new, fresh works of art and statements made paradoxically from stuff that other people made. But then there's also just taking entire movies, entire songs, entire videos, and just selling them, or, you know, your example is very strange. Like, why the hell would someone even want to do that? You know, that isn't even for money. That's just weird. And that's just nasty. You know, that's just, but that's a different conversation, you know? So,
So, yeah. And I'll try and ask this quickly. So the idea of these are two different conversations. As we're moving into an era where things are getting very confused, you know, you have the power elite wants to lock everything down and own it, and then you have this sort of internet culture of everything's free. Can I ask you, in that same idea, since these ideas are getting conflated, how do you see, our generation of media artists putting stuff out into a world where everyone thinks everything's free, or everything, I could just download it and it's mine?
You're fucked, aren't you?
We're fucked. I was hoping maybe you had something to tell me I wasn't fucked.
No, you're fucked. I mean, I get to lecture a lot at art schools, and I always just say, you think you're going to come out of this expensive art school and get some job in the arts, or our culture is going to want to give you money for being creative? No, you're fucked. We hate you. Our culture hates, you know, we don't support and nurture the arts. We don't care. Going back to the TPP, go read the stuff in there on intellectual property. Oh my God! If that thing passes, this conversation that we're having now is going to be really different in a year or two. It's everything they want to really lock down the internet, and it's very scary if that thing passes. What's in there for intellectual property? So, yeah, we're in a weird moment where the internet doesn't really work very well with the way we practice capitalism, right? And we're not scarcity.
We're getting raped from above, and we're not supporting ourselves down below. So.
Correct, because we have a culture. We have this individualistic, you know, American. We have this mean-spirited culture and politics in this country that's part of our national identity. It's me, 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 you know, and fuck all the rest of y'alls. And there's some good things that have come of it, you know, but it's definitely becoming a real problem. And I don't have a solution to it. I mean, one of Negative Land's sort of quote unquote solutions was, look, if we cannot change the world and we cannot change the laws, we are going to do our damnedest to keep making art and being creative as if those stupid rules and laws don't exist. You know, we're going to try and just ignore them. After we were sued, I mean, it was terrible. Negative Land lost more money than any of us would make in 4 or 5 years of working. You know, I mean, it was a huge financial loss. It took up 5 years of our life fighting it. But we emerged from that very much kind of unrepentant, and I'm pretty clear about wanting to continue to appropriate and to quote unquote steal things and make stuff, because we thought this point of view, this way of working was valid and mattered. And we wanted to keep doing what we hoped was both good work, but also set an example for people. And that's, you know, that's one of the small things I can think you try and do. Is you try and set examples with how you live and how you operate, you know, we set examples for one another, and perhaps that encourages and inspires people. But the bigger systemic stuff, which is kind of what you're touching on, is like, holy crap, you know, look at this insane presidential election we're having. We've got the Republicans are basically running 16 Sarah Palins, you know, as bad as one Sarah Palin was bad enough, but now there's like 16 of them, you know, and then we have Hillary, who is essentially, she's just a Republican, you know, she's a centrist Republican from the early 70s, you know, there's, she is not a Democrat really at all. I mean, it's absolutely, she's a nightmare, and she's going to bomb the shit out of somebody when she gets elected. You can guarantee it, because she's going to have to prove she's got more balls than the boys, you know. I mean, she's a warmonger, that's for sure. So she scares me. She really scares me. And plus, she'll say anything. She is someone, at least Bernie Sanders, you know, he's been saying the same stuff his whole political career. He doesn't have to pause and calculate and triangulate when he answers a question. He just answers it. But whereas Hillary's just, all she's ever doing is calculating, working all the angles, you know, triangulating. It's just, it's just a nightmare. She's done that her whole political career. You know, we've all watched it.
So now, as we head out, I'm wondering what you've been working on or what people can expect.
What are we working on? Well, let's see. As you know, one of our main members of our group, Don Joyce, died this summer. So that's huge for all of us. Huge, huge, huge. The group has got, we have one project completely finished that was made with Don while he was alive. Another project that will come out soon.
Awesome.
It's edited from a radio show. We have another project that Don was a huge part of, and that will come out, an instrumental project, a Booper Symphony, that will come out within maybe a year. We're going to reissue the first record we ever made, the one that was done when I was in high school. That's going to come out on vinyl with handmade one-of-a-kind covers. We hope this in 2016. We have a live show that's kind of been on hiatus for a while, but we hope to tour that again. And at least another studio record that's emerging out of all these things that, again, you know, Don's work will absolutely be part of that. And of course, we also just put up 3,200 hours of our radio show. 34 years of Negative Land's weekly radio show went live on the Internet Archive. Over the Edge is the name of the radio show. And that's basically enough stuff for people to listen to for the rest of their lives, I think. that's all free. We're just giving it away. So yeah, there's stuff. I'm doing more solo shows coming up. And what else do we have? I don't know. We got enough stuff to keep us going for a while. At some point, I think enough of us, I mean, just being blunt, enough of us are going to die that Negative Land will one day wind down. But we're not quite there yet. But I never expected, none of us expected when we started this, we'd still be, you know, the group would last long enough to start watching members of our group pass away. I mean, that's a pretty intense thing.
Andras?
You haven't found your Phil Collins yet to carry on the tradition once you've all passed?
Wait, who did Phil Collins find to be Phil Collins?
Oh, no, Phil Collins replaced Peter Gabriel in Genesis.
Right.
And then, you know.
Yes, but he's old.
It's like
now,
the Dread Pirate. Yeah, it's more like, I guess, a Dread Pirate Roberts. So, you know.
Yeah.
Well,
no, I don't think.
So you're not recruiting new Negative Land. You know,
well, we have a fellow who's new working with our group the last few years, who's sort of newer to officially working with the group, John Leidecker, who works under the name Wobbly. But he's actually worked with us since probably 85. But he's been working with us very actively in touring and making records and all that. So, yeah, he's kind of he's the new younger guy. And I can't remember how old he is. I think he's in his early 40s, mid 40s. I can't remember.
I don't just want to dash the dreams of, you know, the young culture jammers of the future, that someday they might join your ranks.
Yeah, well, I know. We've never looked for new, I mean, you know, we've never looked for members of the group to join. I mean, it's just sort of an organic thing that people have gotten. I mean, at this point, there's probably about 8 or 9 people that are all making up the Negative Land sort of Uber family collective.
All right.
You know, there's quite a few of us. Yeah,
I'm calling time of death.
The end.
And Mark, if you don't mind, maybe perhaps you can stay online. We can get a few more things out of the way if you guys want to continue talking. But that was 42 minutes. So, Mark, thank you for sharing it. Thank you so much. It's been a blast.
Sure.
And to everyone out there, you've been listening to Mark Hostler on 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com. To learn more about Negative Land, please visit negativeland.com. That's Negative Land with no second E. For more information about the Sync Book, our guest, to check out past shows or to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes, please be sure and visit our website at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast and would like more, consider becoming a Sync Book Plus member. Some of the membership benefits include full access to the complete audio archives, discounts on books, behind-the-scenes scripts, bonus audio and video, as well as monthly online hangouts with the host. All this and more can be found at thesyncbook.com/membership. Thanks so much, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
It's all in your head.
When it comes to blunting your taste for the normal, we're on the grinding edge.
Look with me to high mountains capped with snow.
The Universal Media Network.
Walk with me in a forest where the wild be strong.
Let us have faith.
Springs warm and gentle breeze.
Let us have faith.
His response will be, well, there's a very important difference. Jesus really was the Son of God. You know, the difference is that my belief is true. So you can only make the observation that there's something similar in all these beliefs from an outside perspective. You know, only if you don't share the beliefs can you say that they reflect the same impulse or that they both represent a kind of supernaturalism. Because if you believe it, you'll say it doesn't represent supernaturalism, it represents truth.
Good idea.
What do you make of this absolutist position that says, you know, this is the revealed word of God and everything else is wrong?
Obviously, in a world where there are competing revelations and where the infallibility of revelation has been questioned, it's very difficult to take such a confident stand, honestly and intelligently. And so we're in a very sort of precarious position at the moment, because on the one hand, we owe our knowledge of God to his revelation, but on the other hand, we can't, I think, point to any particular revelation and say, this is absolutely infallible, this is the whole truth. And nothing else beside it is true.
Good idea.
We have learned to take personal testimony at face value. If somebody stands up and offers searing personal testimony,
let us have faith.
Some awful personal experience or some alleged abuse, we're not supposed to question that. We're not supposed to seek evidence of that. We're not supposed to cross-examine the person who's testifying because that's considered another form of abuse. We're supposed to take that at face value. And there's a lot in the culture that encourages us, I think, to confuse passion and apparent sincerity of belief with truth.
If you don't believe in God, then you're screwed. I mean, and that's not right. So they can't be right.
But now I really have a real good idea.
It's by no means obvious. It's by no means obvious.
The truth of religion may be altogether disregarded. Its doctrines carry with them the stamp of the times in which they are originated. The ignorant childhood days of this human race.
It's by no means obvious that the important scientific questions are all, as it were, matched to the capacity of human brains. And so what we can understand in our human science may be only a tiny fraction of what there is to be understood. And I think the key question is how much of the bedrock nature of reality is within the capacity of human brains.
Because the fact is that I might hold certain views and I believe they are correct for me. But that does not mean that they are absolutely correct. And they don't have to be correct for anybody else. Okay.
What's the best thing you can say about faith?
Not a lot. I think faith is pernicious because it teaches people, especially teaches children, that believing something without evidence is a virtue. And in extreme cases, it teaches people
Or is it just believing that one thing as a virtue?
Either way, I think it's a bit pernicious because I think that children should be taught to seek evidence.
Obey, obey, little children. Obey the King of Kings.
Good morning, don't children.
Accept what is. Accept what authority says is true.
How are you today?
To be taught to be skeptical. If they're told something, they should immediately say, what's the evidence for that?
Allah is powerful and great.
Don't think. Accept what is.
Whereas faith teaches you not to ask for the evidence. It teaches you this is true because it's true because it's true. You just have faith and you don't have to justify it.
Accept what authority says is true.
I think it may be the power of it may come from getting children early. If you're taught from the cradle upwards that certain things are true, you're taught that it's a virtue not to question, you're taught that if you start to have doubts, then you must pray to overcome your doubts. You're taught that if somebody comes along to you with plausible arguments to the contrary, then that's probably the devil speaking. It's a very cunningly planned, I'm not sure it's deliberately planned, it may sort of come about by a sort of gradual evolutionary process, but it looks as though it's very cunningly planned to immunize children when they grow up against all departure from faith. There is a sort of wishful thinking element about that. I mean, quite obviously in the case of surviving after death, because it might be very nice to survive after death, but what's nice isn't necessarily true, and there are people who can't distinguish between what they would like to be true and what there is any evidence is true. And that, I think, might apply also to morality, where people feel, I think wrongly, that you cannot have a moral society without religion. I don't think that's true, but even if it were true, it wouldn't mean that the existential claims of religion were true just because they make people moral. And as I say, I don't actually believe that they do make people any more moral.
Don't think. Accept what is. We all are in this cultural trance.
Has God ever puzzled you, Charlene?
And it made Freud realize there were mental processes that go on very significantly outside of conscious awareness. He puzzled about hypnosis. How is it that I can affect a human being's mind without his consciousness?
Has God ever puzzled you, Charlene?
That there's a powerful influence without the knowledge and the cognition of the patient.
It would be an undoubted advantage if we were to leave God out altogether and admit the purely human origins of all the precepts and regulations of civilization.
The loudspeakers spoke up and said,
there is no God!
Christianity is stupid. 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 Christianity is stupid.
How about group marriage? Or marriage between daddies and little girls? How about marriage between a man and his donkey? Anything allegedly linked to civil rights will be doable.
These rules of living together in relative harmony evolved as a part of the species in order to survive. That is, you can't have organisms that are completely, totally selfish and self-destructive and murderous and so on. No species could survive. So we evolved to be cooperative, altruistic. We practice reciprocal altruism. I'll scratch your back if you'll scratch mine. If there are a cohort of genes for selfishness, there's also a cohort of genes for cooperativeness and altruism. They're both good and bad, not in an ultimate sense, but in an evolutionary sense. It's built into our being.
It's All in Your Head FM.
And now let's go back into history a little bit.
Billions of years ago, there was just a big bang in space. No one knows what caused the big bang, it just happened. And from this bang issued this huge rock. And on top of the rock was found a sweet, brown, bubbly substance. And over millions and millions of years, aluminum crept up the side and formed itself into a can, and then into a lid, and then into a tab on top of the can. And then millions of years later, red paint, blue paint, white paint fell from the sky and pulled itself into the words, 12 fluid ounces, do not litter. And you say, what are you doing? You're insulting my intellect. And so I am, because we know that if a can is made, there must be a maker. And if it's designed, there must be a designer.
We Christians don't call it evolution because we believe it isn't something coming up out of blind nature, but something coming down from the world of light, power, and knowledge beyond all nature.
I mean, one way to put it would be go into a library and spend about 5 years reading a lot of books. And because there are an awful lot of books detailing a huge quantity of evidence, which includes comparative anatomy, comparative physiology, fossils. Nowadays, I think, above all, comparative molecular genetics.
So I'm only one of the many Darwinian biologists who believe we understand the meaning of life.
What is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life is life is a series of machines which are programmed to propagate the instructions that built them, the hereditary instructions that built them. And so that's the biological meaning of life. I hasten to add, that's not, of course, the meaning of life for you and me, because for you and me, the meaning of life is all sorts of things like love and family life and whatever it is we do, whether it's writing books or listening to music. But the reason you're in the world is the biological meaning. Given that you're in the world, then you can make life mean whatever you want it to mean.
If you look at it in detail, the case for the fact of evolution is so utterly overwhelming that it is comparable to the case for the theory that the world is round and goes around the sun. This is a theory which, in principle, I suppose, might one day be refuted, but it's unlikely. And to exactly the same extent is true of the fact of evolution. So in the ordinary sense of the word, it is a fact. There are, of course, many disputes remaining about the details of how it comes about, and that's interesting, but unlikely to be of any interest to our creationist friend. But if I were actually having a debate with a creationist, I think I would probably go on the offensive and say things like, you mean to say you believe that the entire universe began less than 10,000 years ago, after the Middle Stone Age? Thank you very much.
In the timescale of the age of the universe, our human origins take up a tiny fraction. To illustrate this, let's compress the age of the universe from 15 billion years to the present into a single year. So the Big Bang happened at 1 second after midnight, January 1. Then our galaxy, the Milky Way, started around May 1st, our solar system on September 9th, the Earth on September 14th, and life began about September 25th. Plants evolved about November 12th, the first vertebrates on December 19th, and the first dinosaurs on Christmas Eve. Mammals appear on December 26th, birds on the 27th, and the first humans at 10:30 p.m. December 31st. Our first civilizations began in the last 30 seconds. It gives us pause to reflect that paleontologists are trying to fill in the last 30 minutes, which represents 3 to 5 million years.